Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. Well, we're going to get into, I think, some interesting conversations with the conversation, because I'll be talking with one gentleman, John Chambers, but we're going to be talking about a bunch of people. This book is called The Secret Life of Genius, How 24 Great Men and Women Were Touched by Spiritual Worlds. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Donna.
You are such an interesting man. You've run a publishing company. You've written all kinds of materials like Victor Hugo's Conversations with the Spirit World. And you've got such a fascinating background. How is it that you decided that you were going to make research into the lives of people a part of yours? Why were you so curious about all of these things?
Well, I'll tell you how, Donna. Some decades ago, when I was first living in Connecticut, I was a journalist, a freelance journalist, and I was somewhat interested in writing about paranormal phenomena and people's experiences, but I hadn't done much. But then I happened to read that a poet named James Merrill, who I think was considered before he died in 95 to be America's best poet, I read that he had a book of poetry published. This was back in, actually, 1977. 77, he had a book of poetry published called Divine Comedies, with an S. And I read that most of this poem was based on material he'd gotten from spirits on an Ouija board. I was surprised by this. I didn't know what to think about it. My impression was that James Merrill was such an eminent figure that maybe he didn't bother with such things as Ouija boards.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know much about Ouija boards myself. Anyway, I also saw that he lived not far from me. He lived in another part of Connecticut, about 90 miles away. So I called him and I asked him if I could come and interview him. He was very gracious. He said, "Sure, come along and I'll make dinner for you." So we came. Meanwhile, I had read his book, Divine Comedies, and all kinds of quotes from spirits, most fascinating, eloquent, profound material, it seemed to me. So my wife and I went up. He made dinner for us. He took out his Ouija board, and he and my wife began to use the Ouija board, and we were able to talk to these spirits. So afterwards, I interviewed him in some detail about how he'd gotten interested. It turned out that he'd accidentally, with a friend of his, encountered these people on the Ouija board that they were just playing around with. And, I discovered this was a very, very well-educated man, already an eminent poet. And I said, "Well, interest to somebody like yourself is rather unusual. Anybody else who's been involved, any other eminent writer who has been involved with spirits on an Ouija board or whatever in some way?" And he mentioned Victor Hugo. So he showed me a book of some of the first transcripts that were published of the 2.5 years in which Victor Hugo, who of course is the great author of Les Miserables, was involved in talking to spirits when he was in exile on Jersey Island in the middle of the 19th century. Anyway, I went back home and I wrote an article about James Merrill and about his spirits and quoted some of the material. But also it so happened that I know French. I had studied in Paris. I'm Canadian, and I had studied in Paris. And I thought, well, I know French. Why don't I have a look at these transcripts of Victor Hugo's channeling experiences, which hadn't been translated into English at the time. So I looked at them, and I found them fascinating. And I decided, well, one day I'll translate some of these and bring them out. But meanwhile, having talked to these eminent people, having talked to that eminent person, James Merrill, and then having read the experiences of that very eminent person, Victor Hugo, I thought, some very famous some very mentally competent men and women have had these experiences, I thought I would continue to go on finding out who they were. So that's how it began, really. I was terribly taken by James Merrill's experiences, and I was even more taken by Victor Hugo's experiences. In fact, one of the chapters in Secret Life of Genius is about James Merrill, and there I talk a whole lot about what his spirits told him. And, of course, within the traditions, about a year and a half ago, they published my Victor Hugo book, in which I have lots and lots of transcripts. Anyway, that's how it began.
Well, you start in your introduction with the very first sentence, "Are there alternate realities?" Yes, there are. But when you started exploring this, what variables were you fascinated with relative to alternate realities? In today's world, fortunately, we're much more comfortable talking about these things. My goodness, 20, 30 years ago, if they had been able to burn you at the stake, they would have done it. It's amazing how free now and open a lot of this is, and there are so many alternate realities. What are some of the variables you have encountered in your research?
Well, let me think about that for a minute. When I talk about alternate realities at the beginning of The Secret Life of Genius, I'm just sort of setting up a mental game in which I suggest that if certain events hadn't taken place in the 17th century, namely if the city of Prague, which was kind of a center for occult learning, hadn't been conquered, then maybe, for the sake of argument, science wouldn't have, not that long thereafter, taken such a hold on mankind, and we would have continued to be open to paranormal experiences and even begun to see it as a part of the true nature of things. So there I just use that term, alternate realities, in a very specific way to set up a kind of game to launch my book. And in the book, I bring in various people whom I suggest maybe were open enough to still be able to get some glimmering of those occult worlds that were kind of closed down for us, maybe because Prague was conquered and this gigantic source of esoteric knowledge was cut off. But in terms of the things that I look for, well, I was looking for any intimations of what we hear so much about today, namely 2012, namely the suggestion that radical things are going to happen to our civilization in 2012, that we're going to meet up with emissaries from an interplanetary or interstellar council, that maybe we'll all kind of graduate to a higher level of reality and so on. So I was interested in seeing whether or not any of these real famous and very accomplished and very feet-in-the-ground authors whom I knew had some kind of experiences, whether or not they'd had that particular kind of experience or learned any, been told or learned anything about that. So that's one of the themes. And I also was interested in looking at the lives of and experiences of these great people to see how many had believed in reincarnation, how many had, if any, had experiences that suggested that the reincarnation must be a truth about mankind, and so on. So those were a couple of the things that impelled me to write the book. But I was just very interested in finding out, as I had earlier on with James Merrill and then about Victor Hugo, that a lot of great people had these experiences. And, you know, maybe ordinary people like you and me have them. Other people don't listen. But if giants have them, maybe we should listen. And the fact that they have them and talk about them and what they say about them is awfully important.
I agree. Now, let's talk about one of the people, and almost everybody listening is going to know about Sir Isaac Newton. I was really intrigued with the scientific writings that when he died, they were left in the care of his stepniece's husband, staying there till 1936 when they were auctioned finally off at Sotheby's in London, and it only raised about 9,000 pounds. But my goodness, in 2001, someone paid $18,000 for one sheet from one of his manuscripts. This is just incredible. Talk to us about this legacy that he left. This man was so far beyond his time.
He was beyond just about any other human being. He was more than human. But what we didn't know much about until the early 20th century was that along with writing all the scientific treatises that, that Newton is famous for, along with basically creating the science of physics, science of mathematics, Newton was also, without telling anybody, writing a great succession of essays on religion, on Christianity, on biblical times, on Judaism, on all kinds of things like that. And he was doing this because Newton, in putting forth and having published his scientific theories, was aware right from the start that these ideas that he's putting forth could, and when they were made practical use of, be used for evil purposes. He had a kind of intimation of the possibility of technology being used for evil forces. So he was very concerned that somehow or another he complement his scientific writings with a series of writings in which he tried to show that scientific thinking, thinking about the natural world, had at one time in the history of humanity been fused with religious writings, with spiritual writings. He wanted to show that it should be possible to create science that was also spiritual. And so in writing this other long list of books, he was setting about setting books that would offset the negative influence of bad applications of his science. But the thing was that he couldn't tell anybody about it. You mentioned being burnt for witchcraft. Well, not only about 25 years before Newton was born, English clergymen were still being burned at the stake for not saying that God and Christ were one. So we're in the 17th century. It's still a difficult time. So tragically, Newton couldn't tell anybody about what he was writing. But in that chapter, I talk about the findings of what's called the Newton Project, namely scientists, historians in Cambridge, linguists,
yes,
have been putting online since I think maybe 1998, putting online these manuscripts, which are now available, which are on the universities around the world. They're putting these manuscripts online, in many cases translating them from Latin, that Newton wrote in Latin as well as in English, and you have English versions going online as well, multiple versions. It's really fascinating, Don. Everybody should have a look at the Newton Project. They can just key in Newton Project, and they'll go to the site. But what Newton came to conclusions that are still upsetting for many Christians. He came to the conclusion there's a great deal of corruption in the New Testament, that there were many, many allusions to God and Christ being one in the modern New Testament, in the modern versions, that had not been in the original versions. Now, he found this out by checking all kinds of translations going way back, the Syriac translations, Hebrew translations, Greek, everything. He found this out by reading the writings of the church fathers, who from the time of the death of Christ till 1500 BC AD were commenting on the texts of the New Testament. Newton came to the conclusion, which will still be shocking to a lot of people, that the New Testament had been corrupted, and that Christ, although a mighty figure and the second being created by God in the universe, was not one and the same as God. And he came to the conclusion that there had been a kind of a deliberate corruption. And he also came to the conclusion that going back before the New Testament, going back before Christ, certain corruptions had taken place in certain religions. And in all of his writings, and I try to sum this up in my chapter, he goes back to what he considers to be the earliest historical point almost we can find for the form, the shape of religion, and that was Noah landing on Mount Ararat in the ark with records of the very first and the most uncorrupted of religions, which Newton and which his contemporaries called the prisca sapientia, the pristine knowledge. And so Newton was very, very concerned. Well, he could hardly tell anybody at all about it. He told John Locke, the famous English philosopher, about it. That was almost the only person in his time. Very concerned to find out what the true religion was, had been going way, way back, and he was certain that the true religion was a combination of science and spirituality. He was convinced that had religion come up to us in its proper form, it would have contained physics, would have contained spirituality and the worship of God, would have contained them all as a single unit, so that there would have been no possibility of the spread of science also bringing about the spread of evil technologies. Anyway, it's a long story.
Yes. Well, what's so amazing is that all of this was written down by him, and nobody even knew anything about it. And now, because it's at Cambridge, there are all of these researchers that are delving into it. And I agree, if people wanted to research the Newton Project, they should do that. Let's talk about another personality that is well known in history. It's Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. This man, right in the beginning of your chapter, and by the way, you have so many famous personages in here, he talks about when he was 21 years of age, returning one night on horseback to a lady love, and he saw himself on horseback coming towards him on the same path, and he said he was dressed in a suit he had never worn before, a pale gray and with some gold. And it was a vision of some kind. And then it disappeared. But 8 years later, he found that he was on that same road and wearing exactly what he had seen. So it was as if he was flash forward in a time warp of type,
right,
to coming to this road. And it was 8 years in advance. And I have had experiences like that. I've known other people that have had experiences like that. And I found that this is a fascinating beginning to a chapter about this man who, between 1749 and 1832, when he passed away, that he thought the natural was the supernatural.
Something of that sort was true. He's such a different thinker from anybody else who ever lived, and his ideas are so strange that it's kind of hard to grasp that. But yes, he thought that. He did think that the supernatural and the natural were one. So he, in a sense, he didn't think there was such a thing as a supernatural. He just thought we needed to look with more imagination at the natural world. And he certainly thought that sometimes our astral body or whatever became unhooked from the normal flow of time, and it could drift up in the future, and we could see something, and we would be able to remember that, in fact, when the thing actually happened, we would be able to remember that we had foreseen it. So, yes, he had all kinds of very unusual ideas. He was a very powerful man, and he kind of molded his times. His works are 127 volumes long. I don't know how much of them has been translated from German, and everything that he said was kind of catches your interest, is original and striking. If you look at some book filled with his quotes, every one of them is rather offbeat and attention-catching and informative. A very, very unique man, really, and maybe more attention should be paid to what he said about science, but he got kind of bypassed by Newtonian side. But still, here's a great genius who's open to paranormal phenomena. I read somewhere that he believed he'd had 9,000 former lives, but I couldn't find the source for that, so I didn't say it. But there's a lot of kind of gossip and rumor about what he said, but certainly he was really open. A lot of these people were, and we should know about it.
Yes, and I agree. I think they're just fascinating. Jules Verne, this is a man whose writing has affected the lives of millions of people. He and H.G. Wells were often called visionaries before many things came about.
Mm-hmm.
Jules Verne was a man that you talk about him having just this incredible ability. His life was sad.
Terribly sad.
Yeah, it was just a very, very sad life. You called it a gray life.
Yeah.
And yet he just had this knack for writing. He would go into that zone, and
yes.
these stories would just pour out of him. And, you know, he, From the Earth to the Moon was one. There's just so many different things. The Green Ray. In 1882, he wrote about cosmic rays that physicists pursue between two world wars. You have all of these things. Tell us how you found out about Jules Verne.
Well, he's really amazing, like you say, Don. He put it very well. I read his books when I was a kid, like everybody. And then when I was putting this book together, I thought, as some people have suggested, did he really see into the future? You know, did he have some kind of experience? Because, you know, maybe it is possible for people to see into the future. Certainly Goethe thought so. And maybe it's possible for people to see into the future in some kind of, like, organized, systematic way. I mean, maybe they can control it and look into the future when they want to. Anyway, that's really why I decided to bring Jules Verne into the book. And of course, everybody knows and loves his books, too. And, you know, as I researched him and as I put the chapter together, I didn't really see, and I don't know how much I expect to see, that one could prove that he had any kind of knack for seeing the future, although his predictions are amazing. I did notice, like as you said, that he had a very miserable personal life. He seems to have been a very unhappy man, even though he wrote 70, count them, 70 bestsellers. All his books sold were bestsellers in the time. Some of them are still bestsellers, like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He had a very miserable life. His nephew shot him, tried to murder him when he was, 54. The nephew injured him, shot him in the ankle, and Verne had a limp for life. Verne had a son who was just a holy terror and hated his father, and Verne institutionalized him a couple of times, and all sorts of miserable things happened to him. And I began to develop a theory about why all this happened, but I decided not to put it into this chapter, although perhaps I should have, and perhaps I'll put it into a chapter in a later book. But, you know, at the time that Verne lived, with regard to the great interest in paranormal phenomena and talking to the spirits, that was in France in the late 19th century. It began with Hugo, by the time of Hugo. There was also a kind of corruption of these seances. Black magic became, I wouldn't say popular, but there was a kind of underground of black magic. I don't know how effective or real it was, but an underground of people trying to influence other people by using what they called at the time, the vital fluid, which was thought to also enable people to communicate with the spirits via Ouija boards or something like that. But there was a kind of fad amongst a rather miserable lot of people, dope addicts, brilliant morphine addicts and so on, to try to master the arts of black magic in such a way as to influence people from a distance, perhaps make them ill, and perhaps kill them. And there's a famous story in occult lore of the late 19th century about what they call a battle of bewilderment. A couple of groups of quote-unquote magicians got very angry at each other, and they spent about a decade trying to hurl curses from Paris to another town in France at each other, and the head of one of these groups suddenly died of a heart attack. I don't know. It was just caused by the stress, but you did have a kind of underground of things like this operating. Nobody knows if there is anything to it, if that could actually be done. But I couldn't help but wonder if Verne, who was in Paris a whole lot, about whose private life we know so little, couldn't help wondering if he hadn't had some kind of involvement and if there weren't some sort of literal curse on his life, although I didn't get into it in the chapter. It was too speculative. We don't have any proof of that, except that we don't know anything about his private life, and so much could have happened, and it was sort of miserable. Anyway, I don't want to give the wrong impression about his life and about his work, especially. He wrote grand books, entertained millions of people, and still does. His life was surprisingly miserable for a genius, for such a competent, good man in terms of his acts and his books.
Now you've got Winston Churchill in here, Carl Jung, the great psychologist. let's talk about Winston, because this is a man that so often is depicted bigger than life, but he had his own particular spiritual encounter when he was a young man, and he wrote about it in his own autobiography. And what is it that was so special with Winston Churchill?
Well, he was a soldier in the Boer War in South Africa in 1899. He was also a journalist. He was awfully young. I can't recall, 24 or so. And he was taken as a prisoner of war, and he escaped. But he had to go 300 miles, and when he was, at the end of the first day, he thought, I'm never going to make it. I mean, he had nothing. The people who'd taken him prisoner were looking for him everywhere. He was afraid to talk to anybody or go anywhere. And as he describes in his early autobiographical book, My Early Life, he had some kind of an encounter. With the supernatural that directed him at a very crucial moment. I don't want to say too much about it. I don't want your listeners can read about it. But I don't want to create the impression that this was a sort of staple of Winston Churchill's life. He was very tremendously down-to-earth, practical man. Didn't hardly thought about these things at all. And of course, but he was a colossal figure. I would say that he saved the world, really. You read all his writings, his volumes about the First World War, his volumes about the Second World War. He doesn't talk about these things at all. Never thought about these things. So I don't want to suggest for a moment this was any kind of preoccupation with Churchill's. But when he was very young, he had a rather extraordinary experience at a crucial time. And if he had not succeeded in escaping from this prison of war camp in South Africa, if he had been killed, world would be totally different, I would say, in a very negative way. So that one experience is interesting.
You, again, have so many fascinating people in here. What a great book just to take with you if you've got a little bit of vacation time before the kids go back to school, or you just want to curl up with something that'll intrigue you. Well, you know, you start with people far back in history, and you have William Blake, you have Ben Jonson, Nostradamus, Cellini, Victor Hugo, Jules Verne, as we've mentioned, and the list goes on and on and on. Leo Tolstoy, H.G. Wells, Harry Houdini, Sri Yashoda Ma, Doris Lessing, Norman Mailer, James Merrill. All of these, I mean, there's just so many personalities, 24 in fact, and each and every one of them have a unique story, and it's not just about the spiritual side. It's really got quite a bit of good history in it, and I just think that it makes for fascinating reading. John Chambers, give out your website so that people will know where they can go to find out more about you and the work that you do.
Sure. The website is www.newpara, that's all one word, newpara.com, and then a / and then John Chambers, that's all one word, johnchambers.htm.
Okay, so it's www.newpara.com, newpara.com/ johnchambers.htm,
that's
like
it.
Mary.
That's it.
Now, have you got any other projects in the works now that this one has been done?
Well, I'd like to do The Secret Life of Genius 2, How 24 More Great Men and Women Were Touched by Spiritual World.
Great idea.
Because as you suggested, you know, I love talking about the experiences of these people, the paranormal experiences. That's the focus of the chapter. But also, all of these people led fascinating lives at fascinating periods in history, and I also enjoyed very much being able to write about their biographies and about the times in which they lived, and that gives a lot of flair to the chapters. And
I think so. And if nothing else, it empowers us to remember we stand on the shoulders of the people that have gone before us. So mm-hmm. when we can have an insight into history, like with Isaac Newton, whoa, is that an eye opener? And it shows that many times things are put away and people don't realize the value of them, and somebody discovers them, and papers by Isaac Newton. Now you can go to the Newton Project online and you can check it out and find out what they have discovered. John Chambers, it's been a delight chatting with you today. Thank you so much for being my guest.
I enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me, Donna.
It's been a pleasure. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. Don't go away. Don't forget, newpara.com/johnchambers.htm. And then we'll be back in just a moment. The Secret Life of Genius. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast, with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Yes, if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I'd be delighted to do that. Here is the telephone number to call in to, toll-free worldwide, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, the newsletter is going to be out by tomorrow. Tomorrow is the first of the month, and so we're going to have it all ready for you. And, oh, wow, we've got a great lineup of guests coming this month of September, so I want you to know that we'll have all of those details up for you shortly. Also, don't forget, if you're in Washington, a wonderful event is coming up, and it is going to be held in Kent, Washington, on Saturday, September the 26th. The event is the semi-annual Boeing Employees Parapsychology Club Expo. At this expo, and it's been done for years, this is where a lot of local people in the state of Washington, including myself, are going to be there, and there's all kinds of talents and services and wonderful products are going to be made available. It's free to come to, and you are going to be able to find out more about it by going to their website, which is bepcweb.org. That's Boy Edward Paul Charlie Webb.org. They'll give you all kinds of information there if you need directions to get to the Kent Commons. This is a lovely facility. They've been there for the past few years. And it's at 525 4th Avenue North in Kent, 98042. The hours for this wonderful event, it's a one-day event, 9 in the morning until 5 in the evening. So I just really enjoy participating. I have been invited to be a speaker there as well, so you'll be able to hear me while I'm there, and then I'll be doing mini consultations, and I am purging my library, so I'm going to have beaucoup books. And, you know, you're going to be able to pick and choose what you want, but a wonderful selection of materials. You know, when you review 400 to 600 books a year, all of a sudden you realize your home is being taken over by the printed page. So inasmuch as I don't have an Empire State Building where I can put all these books in, I have to go through my library and purge them. So I will have a bunch of those with me. I absolutely love what I do. I had a conversation with someone last week. We were talking about all kinds of different subjects, and they said, my goodness, you can talk about so many different arenas of interest, Donna. Aren't you very, very fortunate? I said, yes, I am. And one of the things that I consider myself especially fortunate about is that I do love to read. I have had a passion for reading ever since I was a child, and it serves you well when you take time to read. And if you find that reading is a tedious process for you, I encourage you to take some reading classes where you could either make reading easier for yourself by developing more of a speed, or you actually start finding what it is that's holding you back that makes you uncomfortable. One person I met a number of years ago was a gentleman who was in his 80s. This man, in my mind's view, was very much like a genius. His family told me that he had never been able to advance in job positionings at any time in his life because he had never learned to read. And this man was of African descent, and he had supported his family very, very well, strong sense of pride, but he had never gotten past first grade reading level. So he learned how to bluff his way through. And he was so good at what he did. He was in the construction business. This man could solve just about any problem. He had a level of ethics. It was just superb. His bosses loved him. They wanted to promote him. But he couldn't read the forms that he would be given to keep records on. He couldn't handle anything because he couldn't read. And so he hid this for so many years, and he would refuse to take advanced positions. And it was so sad because all of his family, he insisted they learn to read. And he himself never went into classes. So I remember having a conversation with the family, and I said, encourage him to sign up for some of the courses that are available at public libraries. There's so many sincere, dedicated people that are out there to help people learn how to read. When you read, you are going to find a world of wonders awaits you. There is so much good information. You don't have to read the rag sheets. You don't have to go and read all of the trash in life. Get to know your local library. Find out about the latest publications. When you're on the Internet, it enables you to explore in so many ways. But the written word has a lot of power to it. And contrary to popular opinion that was being bandied about in the 1990s, they said, oh, we're going to have fewer books. We're not going to have so much paper. Goodness gracious, we've just gone the opposite. We seem to have more paper to work with than ever before. And more books are selling than before. But we are shifting because of the electronic age that we have evolved into. But there's something magical about having a book with you when you're on a plane, or when you're sitting at home and it's just, you're out in your backyard, maybe it's a beautiful sunshiny day, and a book has a magic all of its own. It takes you into worlds that you never would have dreamed you could have explored or you can explore. So when you come across material like The Secret Life of Genius, someone like John Chambers has done a lot of research, has done a lot of investigation, and you have a chance, you have the luxury of being able to take that with you wherever you go and read it, even if you're only able to do a few pages at a time. And it expands your world. It makes you aware of how people were thinking, what individuals like Sir Isaac Newton did. There's just so much you can learn. You never, ever are going to know it all, and that should excite you. Reading is something that I really, really feel has enriched my life in so many ways. Sometimes we're not able to go to college or be in environments because of responsibilities that would allow us to expand our world and our thinking process, thoughts as, in a way that enrich our lives, maybe more efficiently and quickly. But if you're in business, there's business books, there's talking book audios. There's so much out there that you can become aware of, and it just means you take the time. Think about how much stuff on television isn't even worth watching. Pick up a good book. It's really a good thing to do. And by my reviewing as many pieces of this material as I do every year, I just find that my world keeps expanding. And I like to think that maybe through doing this show, your world is expanding too. By the way, the guests that are going to be coming up this week are just a terrific bunch. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about cooking. Ah, yes, I love to do that. Deanna Gunn is going to be my guest. We're going to be cooking with all things Trader Joe's. That's right. If you've got a Trader Joe's market in your area, I think you're going to enjoy this quite a bit. Also, on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about a book that Eric von Däniken has written called History is Wrong. Now, this is real fascinating material. His associate, Giorgio Tsoukalos, is going to be with us on Wednesday, and we are just going to be covering all kinds of good things. And then on Thursday and Friday, because I'm on the road traveling, we're going to be having a repeat of the show that we did live with Ripley's Believe It or Not, and also Conga Serenade, music that I know that you will enjoy hearing again. If you missed the show, I think you'll just really enjoy it. So those are the people scheduled for this week. And again, all of these people, all of the guests for the month of September will be up on bbsradio.com, the information there regarding the Donna Sebo Show, as well as in my upcoming newsletter. And if you would like to receive my free newsletter, it goes out once a month, all you need to do is send me an email. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I, International.com. And say, Donna, add me to your email list. And that way you can stay informed about those guests that are coming up and things that are going on and where I'm doing my appearances, etc. Herbs, oh my goodness, they make cooking a delight. When you use them, they just do so much for a dish, depending on what you use. Well, herbs contribute to wellness as well. The herb thyme, if you have some fresh thyme and you just rub it between your hands, if you're sort of feeling droopy and your energy is low, just rub a few of those fresh thyme sprigs between your hands and just let the fragrance of the thyme come into your environment. It really releases a lot of tension with people. They found that it has a capacity to relax. Vanilla, I think, is my favorite, but thyme comes in, it's close second. Also, basil. Now, we Italians, I'm part Italian. My dad was from Sulmona, Italy, but Sulmona, Italy. Basil is sort of on the sweet side as an herb in my taste buds, and it's a great source of magnesium. Now, why is magnesium important? Well, it helps to regulate your heart and your blood vessel contractions, so it keeps you good and healthy. It's a wonderful, wonderful herb to use. Also, rosemary. Now, I especially like rosemary with pork, and I also enjoy it with chicken. But the antioxidants in rosemary help brain cells. They found in research that it has been a great booster for concentration and memory. So when you're putting this together with your dishes, when you think of these herbs, they can really make a difference. And mint, any of your mints, your peppermint, your winter mint, any of the mints are just absolutely great for digestion and for, you know, let's say, sometimes it's very good for headaches. And then parsley, do you know, it's better than orange juice at helping you fend off the common cold? That's right. And I'll give you a tip. If you juice your parsley, you're going to really get a lot of benefit from it. And it really tastes good. You'll find that it has a very strong fragrance to it when you do juice it. But boy, fresh parsley juice is great for the system, and you don't need a whole bunch. You just need a little bit. So those are five herbs that can enhance your health and make you feel better in life. Let's take a break. When we come back again, phone line is open, 888-815-9756. We're coming right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. By the way, if you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, of course, I'd like to know where you're calling from. Sit back, relax, and just let me tell you what I perceive, and then when I'm finished, you can ask me about a question that is of interest and concern to you. People are so innovative. Again, the number, 888-815-9756. What would you do if you had a chance to be creative, to make something unique and different? I love what people come up with. There's a guy by the name of Boris Bailey that seeks out what he calls aluminum graveyards to collect old street signs. Now, what in the world are you going to do with old street signs? Put them up on a wall in a house? I've seen that done. But make chairs out of them? I've never seen anything like that. And I'm looking at three chairs. They definitely would be conversation pieces. I don't think I'd want them in my house, but hey, it'd be great in a school, or if you wanted to have something really funky and unique, got this guy you can go to. What he does, he collects these old street signs, all kinds of signs, and he hauls them to a studio that he has in Providence, Rhode Island, and this studio is huge. It's the size of a hangar, plane hangar, and he calls them his transit chairs. Now, what he does with bike tubes, yes, that's right, discarded bike tubes he uses as leg supports, and he uses champagne corks for the feet. Fascinating stuff. He says making art with these street signs is pretty tough. He said signs are really a challenge to transform, and I'd agree with him. But recycling. What an innovative idea. This is something that, again, people come up with. And then magnetism. And I've got in front of me a picture of an item that looks like something out of a Jules Verne book. Maybe it was H.G. Wells. I forget who wrote The Time Machine right now. That's escaping me. But there's a British designer that decided that he was going to apply some third-grade science regarding magnetism, and with the Hovert lounger. Now, it's an acrylic chair that stays suspended above its four base pieces. Now, when you sit down in it, it sort of moves with you, but it stays aloft with loads of up to 275 pounds. Now, the inventor of this fascinating chair is Keith Dixon. He came up with this unique seat. It only costs about $12,300. You know, it's just pocket change. And he had tried out other magnetically charged experiments, but he says it didn't work. But this, not only is there a sense of weightlessness and a wow factor, but it can last a long, long time. He said the magnets will only lose about 2% of their power in 20 years, so the lounger will hover long after I'm gone. When you think of things like this, people looking and how can they come up with something different, what can they do that's different and unique, you realize that the human imagination doesn't know any limits at all. And that should be exciting. It's always fun to see what people come up with, especially in these scientific exhibits. I think it's great when they can get the kids together and they say, all right, we're having this science fair, see what you can come up with. And the innovation is just absolutely amazing. Now, I wanted to share some information about some of the latest developments in medicine. One is Comtan. It's an existing medication for Parkinson's disease. They feel that it's also going to be able to be used to fight the drug-resistant tuberculosis. And this is really significant because tuberculosis now has gotten to a level where the typical medications that were used to combat it just aren't doing anything at all. This is a whole new strain that has developed. Now, the biochemists at the University of California in San Diego are feeling very good about perhaps utilizing this medication because TB is coming back. And it's due to poor living conditions, poor sanitation. It's like so many things. When people are in environments where there's just not, where it's just not healthy, it's easy to get this. And mutations have occurred with various diseases, and TB being one of them. It's become a whole different ballgame. And I read about that in the 1980s. There was a man that was in charge of a particular facility dealing with tuberculosis, and he contracted it. And so consequently, he realized that it was a strain that required a whole different type of application of medication because the regular stuff wasn't working. Now, there's an international team of researchers that's reporting that iodium selenide crystals efficiently convert heat into electricity. We're finding new ways of generating energy. This is a thermoelectric material. It would be able to recover waste heat in cars and elsewhere and then put it to good use. And the first ever phase three clinical trial for a malaria vaccine is getting underway in 7 countries in Africa. And they're hoping that the vaccine will be widely available by 2012. Bill and Melinda Gates will be very happy about that because it's one of the things that they have put money towards to be able to eliminate one of the most significant diseases that's been around, and that is malaria. And, of course, it's all related to the mosquito who carries it. It's not affected by it, but it carries it and distributes it. So it is one of the biggest killers throughout the world. Also, we've got some other little bits of trivia. The GPS satellites the brand new ones, may not launch in time to replace some failing older equipment, which could make a big difference. You know, the civilian and military uses of the GPS satellites are quite intense, but who knows? We might get lucky there. And they said even if all greenhouse emissions were to stop today, atmospheric carbon dioxide will remain high for millennia, and ocean surface temperatures will stay elevated even longer. Now, this is a study that came out, and I would have a question with this. If we went and added a whole bunch more trees to the planet, which trees just love CO2, how come nobody's even bringing up the facts about the underwater activity with volcanoes? You know, one volcano can create such change that it's absolutely astonishing. But nobody's talking too much about what's going on under the surface of the waters that are on this planet, and we've got a lot of volcanic activity that's creating a lot of heat. It affects us on so many levels. This is Donna Sebo. We will be back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Lots of good things to share. Tomorrow we'll be cooking. That's right. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a fabulous day. We'll talk with you tomorrow. This is Donna Sebo. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.